Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Okay, welcome to a new series, the 1970s. We are taking the 1970s on. I am going to be the adjudicator. Now, I'm too young to remember some of these seasons. Towards the tail end of the decade, yes, I will be more coherent, but I am going to be chief referee, chit stirrer sometimes, maybe. Tonight we are taking on the 1969-70 season to kickstart the series. We're going to run all the way through the decade. One episode per season. A wonderful decade of football. I grew up on the stories of the 60s and the 70s via my dad. So, you know, these are familiar territory for me, to the point that I almost feel like I lived them. When you hear the passion of the stories firsthand, then, you know, you can fool yourself into thinking this was your era as well. But tonight, the guest very much is the era. We have Paul McParland. Good evening, Paul.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for inviting me to be part of the inaugural episode of this decade series, which got the Baker's absolutely fascinating sequence of football events to be talking about. And what a decade to start with, though. To me, it's the decade when football kind of went into colour, you know, when Match of the Day was broadcast in colour, when the big match was in colour. Suddenly, you know, these black and white figures became life-size colour figures as well. And it's such a fascinating decade, just in terms of, you know, you've got the transition between the managerial giants of the 60s, Revy, Shankly, Catterick, Busby, Allison, Nicholson, still at the helm going into the 70s. So, yeah, it's a real footballing decade with all sorts of events going on.
There's a definite tectonic plate involved. And we'll touch a little bit about Mexico 70 at the end of the podcast. And it is, as you say, it's where colour comes into the equation. Match of the day turns to colour this season. You know, the first game is reputedly Liverpool versus West Ham, although there is a theory that a year before there was a BBC Two test airing of an episode that covered a Chelsea-Manchester City game. So the theory that Liverpool-West Ham was the first one could be erroneous, could well be erroneous. In our opposite corner tonight, we also have Dave Bowler. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening. It's the golden age, I think, in a lot of ways, particularly just the way that the title in particular, the First Division, everybody, you know, there was a chance for every team to have a bit of glory. You know, some of them won it. Some of them came very close. I think the game was open in a way that it probably hasn't been since probably the mid-80s, I think, was probably the turning point. So looking forward to talking about that. I don't know where Paul's getting this colour from. We didn't see colour till 1921. It's a bit posh there.
Fantastic. As a point of interest, Paul, the Granada region, it was an era of, yes, we'd have Match of the Day on Saturday night, but ITV's regions would show up with their own highlights packages, usually on a Sunday afternoon. Paul, the kickoff match, fond memories of Gerald Sinstad?
He was a very established commentator, Gerald Sinstad, wasn't he? My first memories of the kickoff match, I think Barry Davis starts off initially doing the ITV regional commentary before he moves to BBC as well. And I think we've mentioned this before, but the great thing about living in Liverpool at that time was if you bought a special aerial, you could pick up HTV's transmissions as well. Commence on Sunday, you could pick up the big match as well as the kickoff game, and they were all different times as well. So you could switch between the two also, which really helped as well. But it was a really, when you look at the interviews, particularly on regional TV, of the post-match questioning of players, the way they were so open about their feelings and their views and opinions. Yeah, you watch the reruns of the big match now, think, why can't we have interviews like that these days? A bit of honesty, a bit of openness, instead of it all being carefully managed but by the media, honestly.
Oh, completely, completely. Some wonderful footage that goes around. And yeah, the big match revisited is essential viewing if you can find it. I mean, it's a few seasons further along yet, but I can remember when they were doing 74, 75, and you had Stan Bowles and Alan Ball discussing a heated altercation the previous day at Highbury in an Arsenal QPR game. Dave, ATV?
Yes, we had Star Soccer Sunday. I mean, this is a typical 1970s Sunday lunchtime. It was family at war, followed by the world at war, followed by the Beer Down Means Davenport's advert, followed by Star Soccer with Hugh Johns and Gary Newbon. That was your Sunday. I mean, I suppose, you know, you think back to it, with all the regions, we actually had a hell of a lot of football.
Yeah, I've said this before. It's very much an era people think there was no football, but, you know, certainly from a Granada region area, we had Kickoff, which was a review programme on a Friday night after Granada reports. You'd get kind of like Saturday, you'd be on Football Focus, on the ball, you know, results services, you know, match of the day, and then kind of like the Kickoff match on a Sunday. And then you'd be round to the regional programmes on a Monday doing goals rounds up as well. We didn't throw in a bit of sports night and midweek sports special. We didn't actually do all that bad, especially if you're clicking through a turnstile to watch a game as well.
Yeah, and it was all for free, wasn't it, Stephen?
And it was all for free. And it was all for free.
Over the days. Yeah.
And the good thing about ITV's coverage with the regions was that there'd sometimes at the end of the kick match show you the highlights from an Anglia game or highlights from London weekend game that was particularly of interest. So you got a real you always got more coverage than what you got on Match of the Day, because they had the larvae of the region, all the regions they could dip in and out of.
That's right, because what they would do, your region would send usually one camera team to one selected ground. And if that game stank, then they would claw in games from all around the regions. You'd end up being familiar with each region's commentators.
The nice thing as well with the ITV or whatever it was, Granada, they used to every few weeks there'd be a third division game or a second division game. It wasn't always the top division. So, you know, you'd get a down here, all of a sudden you'd be off to Fellas Park to watch Warsaw play somebody or a Shrewsbury game or something.
You would indeed. I can remember, you know, Bolton versus Bury playing a kind of like a third division game that was just epic viewing. You know, it was kind of like one end and the other. I think it ended to like 3-2 to Bury or something. But yeah, it made for glorious viewing. Okay, so 1969-70, you know, a season like Dave said, you know, across the decade, it's an open plane. It's, you know, that capability for teams to kind of like drift in and out of contention. It's, you know, there is no tilted landscape. It's a flat plane surface. And, you know, 69-70 is, you know, a season that very much continues in the spirit of the 1960s, really. You know, across the 1960s, what did we have? 8 different league champions, I think it was. 8 different winners of the FA Cup. And certainly the first half of the 1970s, you know, tied into that. You know, the first, what we're talking, I think it was the first 6 league titles that are handed out go to 5 different teams, I think it works out at. And it's Everton who are out of the blocks in 69-70, Paul.
Yeah, it's obviously a season that has fond memories for me. I was kind of 14, 15 then. So I don't think I went to huge amounts of games that season, but I said it was to a few. And it was, you know, as you mentioned, this thing, you know, it was the start of a new decade, the end of an old decade, when realistically, you know, any team would start off the season with realistic hopes that if they put a good run together, they can mount a title challenge. And you know, in the 60s, United have won the league twice. Liverpool won the league twice. Everton had only won it once so far. And so this is part of the process of Bill Shankly, was in the process of building this second great team. You know, Patrick was in the process of building his second great team as well. And it was a slow measure of improvements from when they won the cup in 66, was almost the last hurrah of the old guard, Alex Young, Derek Temple, players like this, Jimmy Gable, to the new players coming through, Joe Royal, Harry Kendall, Colin Harvey, new signs like Alan Ball. And from finishing 11th in 65-66, the 68-69 season, Everton had finished third and were getting very closer to mounting that title challenge. And so the 69-70 season is the start off of the third degree of optimism. I mean, surprisingly, there were no big money signings that summer, which you normally expect the teams to have made when they're challenging for the league title. But Patrick stuck with the team that, you know, done well from the previous season. And it was a strange season because of the World Cup in Mexico, the decision had been made that the season had to finish by the end of April. So it was the earliest finish for a long time in the Football League. So Everton played 7 games in the first 22 games of the season, of which they won 6 and drew 1, so already the kind of seeds of optimism and hope there as well. The key result in that sequence was on the 30th of August, Everton faced the Leeds United team, the reigning champions, who had not lost since the 28th of October the previous season. I think it was like 28 league games unbeaten. And it was a thrilling game at Goodison. Everton went 3-0, Leeds got back to 3-2, Everton hung on for dear life, and they managed to cling on to the victory. So that was a really significant moment at Everton that season, beating Leeds United 3-2. And Leeds were proved to be the viable throughout the season anyway, so that victory did come in really useful when the points were tallied at the end. And Everton made a really good start. I mean, they were never out the top two apart from one week, I think, in October. And a couple of things kind of helped Everton keep moving forward that season. One, they got knocked out the FA Cup in the third round by Sheffield United. Now, although at the time that didn't go down too well with the support, I think in some ways, when you saw what happened to Leeds United that season, not having the complication of the FA Cup also helped them measurably as well. It just gave them a focus. It gave them the lead to focus on. As I'm sure your father's told you a few times, Stephen, there was the infamous 3-0 Liverpool derby win at Goodison, which kind of set off a slight derailment of Everton's hopes that season, that the classic Sandy Brown own goal. And it just seemed then as though Everton's momentum were being jarred, knocked off course. For the next nine games, Everton only won two and dropped down to second behind Leeds United. But then eventually, they got themselves back on track again. They did go to Anfield later on in the season, kind of redressed the first derby defeat by winning 2-0. And last 14 games of the season, Everton remained unbeaten and just really found form at the time when Leeds United, with their fixture congestion, were starting to struggle to field full-strength teams in key matches, and had almost kind of lost the momentum and drive to keep them in the hunt for the league title. And a couple of things made a big difference last season. One was that Alan Whistle came into the team in the last 10 games, scored 8 goals, and they really helped to get crucial victories to get the team over the line as well. Roger Kenyon came in for Brian Laborde, who was injured for the second half of the season. And a consequence of that was Alan Ball became captain as well. And Ball received a lot of credit for his motivation of the team that second half of the season to get them over the line, to make sure that they won the title. The only signing they really made during the course of the season was the England fullback Keith Newson, who came in and kind of covered for Sandy Brown in the left-back slot. They finished with 66 points, which I think after Leeds United the previous season was the second highest total of points to win the first division title. And it just seemed then that everything was set for a bright future. I think Alan Ball made some comment that, you know, that the future... He said, this team is certain to go better. How can we fail with such talent in our squad? And that those words kind of came back to haunt him, because as we discussed even on the End of an Era podcast series we did with you, which anyone has listened to that, well worth digging out again. It's a fascinating series. It just didn't happen for Everton. You know, the 70-71 season, 7 days of cost Everton a European Cup bid, cost Everton an FA Cup bid, and you never quite recovered from that. But the 69-70 season is possibly, arguably, Patrick Grace's achievement, because he had to rebuild the team, and he didn't particularly do it this time with massive checkbook signings at the start of the season. He had the team in place, with a work in progress, brought youngsters through like Joe Royal, who scored 23 goals that season, Johnny Modesty, who signed from Liverpool, scored 9 goals that season, and he made some changes to the coaching staff as well. Stuart Imlach, whose son Gary Imlach presents the Tour de France coverage on ITV4. He was the Everton coach as well. So, yeah, all in all, it was such a hugely successful season. It should, I think a lot of the magazines and football press at the time were proclaiming, if the one time you looking back, you never want to have, Everton will be the team of the 70s, Everton will dominate the 70s, didn't happen. Other teams rebuilt, Everton stood static. And so that 69-70 then became the standard by which all the teams that followed in their wake were judged against. And so Harry Kendall arrived, none of them managed to make the mark.
Yeah, a blessing and a curse, that team, really, Paul. Alan Ball was 10 goals from midfield as part of that fabled school of science. As you say, Johnny Morrissey, the contribution of Joe Royal. That Merseyside derby defeat was the only home defeat in the league that season. There was a pivotal moment over the kind of like Christmas New Year period. Lost at Leeds on December 27th, just 24 hours after Leeds had lost at Newcastle, and then went out the cup at Sheffield United, like you said. But from there, 16 games from the end of the season, just the league games to play. I think there's only one reversal. Like you said, came to Anfield, got the win to redress the balance from earlier in the season and won it comfortably. I mean, 66 points in a 2 points for win era translates to 95 points, I think it works out at, under 3 points, which wouldn't come in until 1981-82. You know, this is a, you know, an all, Dave, this is an all-encompassing Everton title win, you know, in the face of a very strong Leeds and, you know, a defiant Chelsea as well. You know, we go on to have their own success. I mean, what tends to fall under the radar is that that Chelsea finished third this season as well as winning the FA Cup.
When you look at the final league table, I mean, it looks like Everton absolutely walked away with it. I mean, was it 9 points, I think, in the finish that cleared the Leeds. But I was looking at the table with 7 games to go, there was a point in it. You know, Leeds were still absolutely there. And okay, Leeds fell away. They got 5 points out of that last 7 games. But I don't think it had mattered because Everton won 7 of them, won 6 of them and drew the 7th, which was the last day of the season when the title was already won. And it didn't matter by that stage. I mean, I always like to see that in a title winning team, one of those teams that just in the last sort of, you know, 2 or 3 months of the season just lays waste to everybody else and they win every week. If we get to the 1980s, Stephen will be talking about this every season. But, you know, when a team really gets the bit between its teeth at that point, as you're coming into the, that's when you see a proper team. I think that's, you know, when it really matters. And they just start churning their way through. I mean, the last defeat was 17th of January, you know. So to go from that 3 months to the end of the season in, as we said, a first division that's a proper level playing field where I wouldn't go so far as to say anybody can beat anybody, but, you know, there was a much greater chance of it than there is in terms of the Premier League now. It was much more likely that, you know, you would go to any team, particularly away from home, and be turned over. And Everton didn't do that. They just absolutely ploughed the way through that last third of the season, really. And as you say, only a point short of what Leeds did the season before, which everybody was saying, well, nobody's ever going to get this kind of total ever again. And you know, Everton were, you know, within a hair's breadth of doing it. I mean, yes, Leeds, obviously, as happened so often to Leeds in that era, they were going on every front possible and they did run out of steam. A little bit in those last sort of 6-7 weeks of the season, but I don't think any of that takes away from what Everton did. I mean, 66 points.
It speaks for itself. 66 yeah. points. No, never buy into that concept. You know, you don't win a league title by accident.
No,
or by default. You know, you might have seasons where more than one team would be worthy champions, but you know, you win a league, you deserve to win the league title. You know, I'd say exactly the same about Aston Villa in 80-81. You know, when Ipswich are used as a bit of a you know, a weapon to beat over the head of that team, it doesn't wash for me in that respect. And you know, this Everton side, you know, fully deserving league champions. You know, and Paul, they supply 4 players to Alf Ramsey's squad.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
It could have been more. It would have been more if Gordon West would have been willing to travel. And there were a few other contenders that were on the periphery as well.
Yeah, and how Gold Weston, when we saw the Everton by the England World Cup in 1970, you wonder if Weston being the deputy keeper to the Benassi, how might things have worked out, we know.
Well, that's it, because he did go to Mexico a year earlier.
He did, didn't he? Yeah, and he did, played, yeah, yeah.
He had that experience of having played in Mexico 12 months earlier. Dave, you know, other contenders for the league title, yes, we've mentioned Leeds, we've mentioned... Or certainly honourable mentions in the first division. I mean, Derby County, first season back up in the first division for quite some time. I didn't check how long they'd been away from the first division, but obviously Brian Clough brings them up 68-69. They finish fourth. You know, it's a magically stylish side. Kevin Hector, you know, at the heart of a great deal of it. You know, we'll come on to Kevin Hector. You know, there's a link to Kevin Hector with regards to Bradford Park Avenue to be mentioned a bit later on. But, you know, I watched a bit of footage earlier today of them dismantling Tottenham at the baseball ground 5-0. And it's a wonderfully stylistic, you know, short bout of highlights. But at the same time, you get an exact feel for just how good this team was. And this was a bit of a marker that Derby County were laying down as well.
It's a question whether that Derby County team was better than the Nottingham Forest team that did win the league under Clough straight out of the second division. At the back end of the decade, which we shall come on to in due course. I mean, they were a fabulous side, no question about it. Very unlucky a few years later in the European Cup, not to go on. I mean, some marvellous players. And the football they played, when you I mean, as we said earlier, we got Star Soccer. We used to see Derby on a regular basis on a Sunday. And that pitch at the baseball ground, I mean, you know, yeah. I think they grew cabbages on it or something. I mean, it was absolutely horrendous. Once you got to September, that pitch was unusable for anything. And yet they played this amazing football on there, which perhaps it was to their advantage. But, you know, you look at Roy McFarland, what a fantastic player he was, you know. And Dave McKay was the engine of that team when they came back up. And then that great run in the first division to finish fourth. I mean, you know, he was a right to the end. Dave McKay was a formidable force. You can't help but think of Dave McKay, and you immediately think of that picture of him and Billy Bremner holding him up by the scruff of the neck. They were a terrific side, and it's partly how good they were, and it's partly the times as well that allowed them to come up and have that success in the first division, because they weren't, you know, completely out of it in financial terms. You know, by the time they got up, obviously they'd put a good side together, and the disparity between them and an Everton or a Liverpool or a Leeds financially wasn't as huge as it was. I think that's one of the things that does make the 1970s such a great story in general, that there were so many of those teams that came up from Division Two. And okay, they didn't always go and win the league, but you know, they quite a few of them got into the top five or six the following season, just because they were well-run teams, they knew what they were doing, they were well organised, and the opportunity was there to go and make a statement straight away. And Derby certainly did that. And we'll talk about Chelsea a little bit more in connection with the FA Cup, but that was a terrific Chelsea team. 53 points, I think they finished on, which, you know, in a normal season would have taken them fairly close to winning the league. You know, quite often it was 56, 57, 58 points that won the first division. Just that, you know, that Everton team was, that season was just absolutely exceptional. And I mean, as Paul was saying, the surprise is that they didn't really go on from there and continue to be at that same level for much longer.
I mean, the way the Star Soccer must have been pretty interesting that season, Dave. I mean, Coventry City had their very best league season ever, finished sixth out of absolutely nowhere, 20th place the two previous seasons, their first two seasons of top flight football, at a time when it's still only two up, two down until 1973-74, so 20th place is enough to keep you up. Then suddenly they finished sixth in 1969-70. A young Dennis Mortimer in that midfield, Billy Carr, they have a great deal of young talent in there. You know, where does this come from? I mean, it's it, and again, you know, this is a season in which Aston Villa are relegated to the third division as well. So it's, you know, the big omnipresent Aston Villa struggling so much. West Brom make it to Wembley in the League Cup final. You know, there's so much going for Midlands football at this point in time. Derby rising in the East, but it's Coventry. You know, I find I've tapped them into the internet this morning because we're looking at, and I knew of this, you know, half decent Coventry side because of the qualification for the First Cup and all that. But yeah, when you come to kind of like tapping Coventry City 1969-70, there is no literature out there. There's just the solid stats of a season full of results. I mean, surely there's a Coventry City fan out there that really needs to put a bit of flesh on the bones of this season.
Coventry is one of those just amazing stories, full stop, isn't it? You know, they came from absolutely nowhere, got into the First Division and stayed there forever.
34 years, I've got to bring that. One visit to the top flight that lasted for 34 years, and in those final years, they were the fourth longest consecutive serving team that were existing in the top flight. Man United had gone down, Tottenham had gone down during that period of time. There was only Arsenal, Everton and Liverpool that had stayed longer in terms of consecutive years since promotion. Than Coventry had until they went in 2001. You know, obviously they win the cup in 87, which kind of like absorbs so much light, but this 69-70 vintage is kind of like one of the very best.
I think one of the great things Coventry had over that period, that early period that got them through the divisions and into the first division, it was like it was a crusade, I think. Yeah, Jimmy Hill did great work there with you know, fan buses to away games and the first ever colour match programme, and
he had the Sky Yeah, the Sky Girls, didn't he, Dave, did doing the dancing before the game starts as well. Yeah, the Sky Blue special trains as well, which was such an upgrade on the normal football carriages you went to on away matches. Yeah, he really was a football innovator, wasn't he?
Electric scoreboards eventually, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
The first all-seater stadium in.
And even the stadium where those stands, all the roofs had that up and down undulating design to them.
There was something certainly left field about Coventry that was massively endearing about them.
Yeah, I mean, he was a great innovator. And also, I've always thought this is a big, big thing. Coventry was, you know, a boom town at that time in the 60s into the early 70s, you know, the car industry and whatnot. And it was all going really well. And obviously, things then changed in the 80s quite considerably. But I do think that that's a big thing. You know, I mean, Harold Wilson always used to say about the Labour Party, it's a crusade or it's nothing. I think that's pretty true of a football club as well. You know, you've got to have a goal somewhere. You've got to have a name. You've got an objective. And, you know, whether it's everybody hates us, we don't care, or, you know, you're being the innovators and you're trying something new, or you're playing a particular brand of football that thrills all the neutrals. If you've got something like that, then I think you've got something to build on. And momentum is everything, I always think, in football. You know, if you've got the momentum going in the right direction, then it takes some stopping. And that was what Coventry had for quite a while, you know. Eventually it ran out of steam, but, you know, for that period, it was an amazing thing.
I fully agree. It's a, you know, a significant part in their history, and they fully contributed to the season without a shadow of a doubt. Just very quickly, Paul, down at the opposite end of the table, it was Sunderland and Sheffield Wednesday that went down. Sunderland, I think, scored about 30 goals at the very most, I think it was. I think it was Stockport County in the entirety of the four divisions that scored the least this season, went going down to the fourth division with 27 goals scored. It was 30 that Sunderland got. Yeah, big casualty in Sunderland, but, you know, it wouldn't be an unfamiliar thing for them moving forward.
No, it was the first of many, wasn't it? I think wouldn't have realised that at the time as well. And also, Sheffield Wednesday went down. So they're two quite, you know, I mean, this is Sheffield Wednesday team who ran Tottenham close to double 60-61. Yeah, exactly. They're a really, really strong team, and with a fabulous stadium as well at the time. But both those teams were on a serious decline. You know, poor signings, you know, poor appointments as managers. I mean, Sunderland wasted a few years previously, spends a fortune on a well pastor, Jim Baxter, who didn't really fit in there particularly well. Yes, Sheffield Wednesday, I think they had a young Jack Whittam in that team, who I think, you know, would be signed by Liverpool a couple of years later, who looked a really exciting prospect. But it was a team that kind of aged, and young players hadn't really come through to give them a way forward. And yeah, it was the start of both teams coming down from the top table almost, to, you know, having to adjust to life outside the top division. Yeah, I mean, it would take Thunder quite a few seasons to get back, wouldn't it, under Bob Stoker, you know, in kind of, I think, 75, 76, they came back up again. Sheffield Wednesday would have to go down to the third division, wouldn't it, before they start their climb back again as well. So it was quite a landmark season for both of them. And interestingly, has Everton's fixtures worked out that season? You mentioned before, Dave, about, you know, winning the title with a few games to spare. Everton's last two games were away at Sheffield Wednesday and a Sunderland, who both, you know, I think, were probably relegated by the stage anyway. So even if they hadn't quite got the number of points they needed, they still had two games there to go and probably get results from as well.
I mean, that's the converse side of what Dave was saying about teams coming up and acquitting themselves well. Up at the end of the spectrum, you've got teams going down and labouring to get up. You know, yeah, Sunderland, it was 76, but they had the compensation of FA Cup success in 73 to comfort them somewhat. Yeah, Sheffield Wednesday about a decade and a half before they returned. But yes, you know, it made for a fascinating kind of landscape, basically. I mean, moving on to the FA Cup. Paul, you know, you said earlier on, FA Cup final, April 11th, an odd sensation.
Yeah, it was so early, wasn't it, in the season? And it came at a really bad time for Leeds. It says their fixture congestion. I think they end up on like 15 games in 44 days or something back like that, which actually didn't help at all. The replay, in my view, always gets a really unnecessarily negative press. I just thought it was of its time. You know, people looking at all those tackles, but all those should be five red cards. Well, most league games I watched in that era were like that. They were crunching tackles. You know, you had players like Chopper Harris who would decapitate you, then win the ball afterwards. You know, it was, you had to be strong to survive. So, you know, any, if you spoke to anyone who watched a game on TV or was present at the stadium when they came out of the ground on that evening, they wouldn't say, oh, that was an awful game. That was, there were too many free kicks from my, like, there was too much off the ball stuff going on. They loved it because that was kind of the way things were then. You know, and you had to battle to get your victory. So I can watch that replay time and time again because there's such a combination of sumptuous skill with thickening savagery all in the past of 120 minutes. And you see that challenge on Peter Benetti, for, I think, from Mick Jones early on. But he's actually hobbling around for the first next 10 minutes before he can get himself back up to a fit state to withstand the bombardment. And then the quality of all the goals, I mean, Lee's first goal, great finish by Madden Clark. Chelsea equaliser, the move from Coop to Osgood to get them back to 1-8, and then you just got an extra time. You know, as you said, Steve, I think at the time, it was the first time a team that finished third in the table met a team who finished second in the table in the FA Cup final. So they were really, really closely matched as well. And of course, that's not without even going into the hostility and enmity between the two teams, who actually couldn't stand the sight of each other. And you know, it was almost like stereotypes, wasn't it? This image of Leeds as the dull, savage northerners, Chelsea, the skillful, flamboyant, you know, playboys, you know, but it wasn't quite like that. I mean, I mentioned before, you know, Chelsea had Chopper Harris on the side. That Eddie McCready was also a bit of a hard guy as well. You really wouldn't mess with him. Ian Hutchinson up front for Chelsea was actually battling around through televised defenders. And Leeds, conversely, some sumptuously skilled players. Eddie Gray, you can watch that guy play football all day long. He was so skillful. Billy Bremner, in between, you know, his savage tackling, was a very, very skillful player. Johnny Giles could hit a pass that nobody else could see. Peter Lottimer, what a forward he was. So there were two interesting teams, but there are huge similarities between both of them as well. So I still think that's up there as one of the best cup finals for drama, for incidents, you know, for keeping you engrossed on what was going on in front of you. And I still think they still have the highest TV audience figures for a football game that's not a World Cup game in the UK. It was the last game of the season as well, wasn't it? It was on the 29th of April to replay. So it was kind of, you know, a fitting end to what was such a dramatic season in all the domestic competitions and in the European competitions as well.
Dave, a work of art, the 1970 FA Cup finals.
It is the height of the beautiful game, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul's right. It was of its time. You know, I was six at the time, and it was one of those nights I was allowed to stay up a bit late to watch the cup final replay on a Wednesday night or whatever night it was in the week, Thursday night. It was fantastic. I mean, that was how football was played then. It was, you know, roaring tooth and nail, as they say. I mean, that was the nature of the game. A few years ago, there was some company put all the cup finals out on DVD, and you could buy, I think, I don't know, going back to the mid-60s through to the early 2000s. That was the only one that I bought. I've still got the DVD here. Because the Wembley game was a great game. I mean, Eddie talked about Eddie. I mean, at Wembley, he was absolutely electrifying, a fantastic performance. And then, of course, Chelsea decided to kick him out of the replay if it was possible. Some of the tackles, in those days, the tackle from beyond wasn't so much outlawed as compulsory. I can understand why forwards were very keen on it, but it was a spectacle of sorts. It was, I don't know that there's ever been a more thrilling cup final in all the years since. You know, the perhaps been better games technically to watch or whatever, more entertaining in different ways. But I think that one had absolutely everything to it. And weirdly, I think the fact that it wasn't the replay wasn't played at Wembley, but it was played at Old Trafford somehow added to the spectacle for that replay, because, you know, you were back at a normal proper football ground and everything was, you know, right up close to the touch lines, and it was, you know, you could see the supporters, and probably, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure the two clubs got far more tickets for that game than they did for Wembley, because obviously the FA Blazers weren't going to go as far as Manchester, God forbid. So, you know, it was the proper supporters that got to that game, and it was just electric, the whole. You know, you could feel it coming off the telly. It was, that's that, you know. You don't get better games than that, I'm sorry.
You're right, David. It was such a competitive game, but it was also such a skillful game as well, because there are some moments of actually glorious football in it throughout it as well. And, you know, the standard and the pace of the game doesn't drop in extra time. If anything, it goes up a notch in extra time, the intensity. And you made a really good point there about the crowd atmosphere. But I'm not quite sure how the allocation worked out, but I've got in my head there was something like, I think it was 14,000 for the Wembley final for each set of fans. I've got to think it might be as high as 25,000 for the replay at Old Trafford. And that, you know, the closeness to the pitch as well, because the old Wembley with that gap behind the goals never quite had the same atmosphere as a league fan. So, yeah, it just had absolutely everything, you know, and why it gets maligned so much these days. And, you know, because to me, I don't know if you can get on DVD. I mean, that's something I'll be looking at today. Because it is just a classic football game of its time. And you've got all the elements of 60s, 70s football there. You know, you've really had, you've got, you know, a league team who would go on to win the league title in a couple of seasons. I've got the Chelsea team who go on to win the Cup Winners' Cup. So, yeah, it's just a real fabulous piece of football, you know. I'd invite anyone not to watch it. And if you watch it through the lens of what football was like in the 70s, you get so much more enjoyment from it. It's easy to think, oh, that's a terrible time. Oh, that wouldn't happen these days. But watch it and see how the players, you know, there's no rolling down. There's no like Bruno Fernandes type theatrics where you're rolling down, may not you're being hit or hurt, because at the time it was a massive pride not to show that you're being hurt or injured. And you know, I think once again that's an element of the modern game that really does frustrate me, because you just love to see someone at the end of a crunching tackle just get on with it like nothing happens to them at all. Goodness.
I mean, between the two games, it's got a little bit of everything. I mean, that terrible pitch at Wembley that year. You know, Gary Sprake's eccentric goalkeeping, even Jack Charlton's struggles with getting the ball off the goal line. You know, yet some wonderful football played. You know, like you say, I mean, I forget who it was, but just transfixed by a kind of off-the-ball altercation as punches were being swung. And it is an absolute joy to watch. I've sat and watched these games, and you know, Dave's right, you can get that. I managed to pick up an old VHS of it years ago. The BBC did the same thing. They released the cup finals on video, and it was even better with David Coleman's commentary on it, because I think the DVDs that came out, they used ITV's footage of it. It was Brian Moore for most of those commentaries. But this was a, you know, an amazing game, and even like, you know, the semi-finals offered something as well. You know, Watford's run to the semi-final. You know, Leeds semi-final against Manchester United went to three games to split them in an intriguing season for Manchester United as well, in that they, you know, they reached the semi-finals of both domestic cup competitions, lost out to Leeds in the FA Cup to Manchester City in the League Cup. And you know, this brings us to Joe Mercer and his Manchester City side, who have a bit of an inconsistent league season, finished 10th, but they take the Cup Winners' Cup. And they take the League Cup as well against Dave's West Brom in what was kind of the last hurrah of Joe Mercer's side, you know, that had won the title in 67, 68, won the FA Cup in 69, and did this cup double in 69, 70. Dave, you know, Joe Mercer and Manchester City throw in Arsenal there as well, who take the first cup. You know, 69, 70, there's a lot of success shared around. And some on the European stage as well.
The Manchester City thing, I mean, you're right, it is kind of the last hurrah for City, and it doesn't really make any sense, because, I mean, as you say, they'd won the league in 68, and just looking at the team that won the League Cup final, you got Colin Bell, Mike Summerby, Francis Lee, Tommy Booth, Mike Doyle, Joe Corrigan, and they were all relatively young players at that stage. They were still all going to play for another 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, a lot of them. Colin Bell would have, you know, probably seen out the 70s had it not been for his injury. And then City probably should have gone on and done a lot more than they did in the 1970s. But that was the Manchester City that we all know and love, and managed to cock things up from the jaws of victory on a regular basis through that period. But they were a great side. The League Cup final was played on a terrible, terrible pitch. I mean, worse than anything in the baseball game. It snowed during the week. And they cleared the snow off it. I think they'd had the Horse of the Year show had been there as well at that point. So the pitch was mud and straw And they would never have played it had it not been a cup final. It would have been postponed. And Francis Lee, they talk about people with thighs like trees. I mean, Francis Lee genuinely was like that, and he ploughed through the mud and the, you know, he won City that game. He was outstanding. But they had such great players. I mean, Colin Bell was a fabulous footballer. And then they went through the European Cup Winners' Cup and got to the final. Gornik Jabuzay in the final. Malcolm Allison, who we should mention, of course, rated Lebanski before the game. Lebanski is as good as Eusebio, which sounded like typical Malcolm Allison nonsense, but was probably closer to the truth than we, you know, anybody gave credit for at the time. And City went on and won that. And you know, I think they were the first English team to win a domestic cup and a European cup in the same season at that point.
Technically, when the FA Cup, because the Cup Cup final and the FA Cup final, people played on the same night.
That's right.
So that's why the City game was not on TV. It wasn't shown live. And technically, when the replay went to extra time, at that moment, City were the holders of the League Cup, the FA Cup, and the European Cup Winners' Cup, technically.
Fantastic stuff. But I mean, that City side, Paul, I mean, as Dave said, you know, they had a lot of talent, a lot of players with time on the side. The similarities of Everton in that respect, I mean, the 69-70 Everton, a lot of talent, and a lot of those players have plenty of time on the side as well. I mean, it's unerring, really, that, you know, both ends of the East Lancashire Road had these two, you know, significant sides that didn't fulfil. They did fulfil because they won, you know, some of the biggest prizes there of that season, yet it would fall away. Manchester City would come close to the title in 71-72, but that schism at boardroom level and in the dressing room, you know, Mercer taking one side of a tussle for power at Manchester City, Alisson on the other, and it falling Alisson's way. Just how crucial was it to be that Joe Mercer would lose out in that power vacuum?
I think there's certain similarities there, isn't there, Stephen? So, you know, I think part of the reason for Everton's decline, arguably, was that, you know, Harry Katcher had a few kind of health issues. He wasn't quite as fully focused as he should have been. The quality of signings deteriorated. He wasn't the sole key players, and it kind of all went downhill from there. Certain similarities with City, as I mentioned there, in that, you know, the Mercer Alisson combination worked really well. You had the young tracksuit manager, full of ideas, full of innovations, but combined with the experienced manager who knew what worked, and you had to get the best out of players who knew the best formations to play. And as a duo, they almost worked the perfect synchronicity. As Dave indicated before, the trophy they won in that 3-year period, with a quite a youthful team as well, should have gone on to do far better. And you do, you know, we often talk the sliding doors moments, you know, what if Mercer and Alisson had come to some sort of, I don't know, refreshment that they kind of, you know, they agreed to work with each other, maybe give Alisson a little bit more responsibility. I don't know, because certainly Mercer and Alisson together worked exceptionally well. Alisson by himself, apart from 71-72 season, when it looked as though all the best being placed at Alisson as opposed to Mercer were paying off, just never ever quite had the footballing experience to listen to advice. I think Alisson was a very headstrong coach, and sometimes you need an experienced guy in the back to say, actually, no, I wouldn't do that. No, try that. But once he became the number one person at City, and then the Peter Swells in particular placed all his faith in Malcolm Alisson, it was kind of, without talking to rein Alisson in from his kind of wilder ideas, I think, you know, that ended up costing City quite a bit.
Yeah, I think you're totally right there, Paul. It's certainly the way that it seems that it tails off. I mean, it's interesting, Dave, that, you know, Joe Mercer eventually goes on to Coventry City, where he teams up Gordon Milne. You know, they spin a little bit of magic on a more modest level, to the point that when Alf Ramsey, will come to it later in the series, but when Joe Mercer takes the caretaker job of the England manager, you know, his name is connected to the job on a more permanent basis. At least, you know, before Reevey becomes the omnipresent figure. But the talk of, like, Gordon Milne being in that role with Mercer for England would have been an interesting alternative reality.
we talked about in various podcasts at various times in connection with various things, but that bit of experience when it really comes down to it, you know, when it's the big games at the end of the season, or if you're talking internationally, that experience is absolutely invaluable. But at the same time, you know, you do become a person of your time and it becomes difficult to change, which is why I'm still banging on about the 1970s, I suppose. I think what they actually had with Mercer and with Alison was the best of both worlds. Naturally, you know, the younger person has got that ambition. Well, okay, if I didn't have this old duffer with me, I'd be even better and I could make my own name and people are saying he's great and really it's, I'm doing all the work. Yeah, if you could just get a situation where those two, I mean, this is life all over, isn't it? But, you know, if they could have just found that way of working together, then that was an unstoppable pairing, really. Yeah, if you look at Manchester United, if Matt Busby had stayed in post for another couple of years with Wilf McGuinness working for him as opposed to being the manager at that point, would something like that have worked better at Manchester United? Would that have been a transition that would have worked better? But, I mean, it's a personality thing with Malcolm Allison, because all through his career he was one for, you know, the outlandish and for taking a gamble and you know, chancing himself. I mean, when he went back to City in the late 70s, you know, and he completely demolished that team and spent fortunes on younger players and set City back for donkey's years, didn't he, with his spending there. Malcolm Allison always needed somebody to rein him in. And Joe Mercer was particularly good at that. And, I think the avuncular Joe Mercer thing belied the fact that he knew the game inside out. You know, he'd been in the game for his entire life, going back to before the war. You know, he'd seen it all, done pretty much most of it. He was the one that just stopped Malcolm Allison going berserk all the time. Brian Clough, I suppose, in a sense, was like a Malcolm Allison. And Peter Taylor, although he was of the same kind of generation, the same sort of age as Clough, he at least managed to hold him down at times. And I think very often somebody who is ahead of their time or an original thinker, that's great. But there is somebody who needs to keep your feet on the ground and keep you tethered to reality a bit. And as soon as Joe Mercer lost that power struggle, that was always going to be the end for City, I think.
Again, just one of those fascinating kind of, you know, as Paul said, like end of an era kind of scenarios. I mean, Paul, Arsenal take the first cup. They're going to finish 12th in the league. You know, there'll be plenty about Arsenal in the next episode. But, you know, this first cup win was pretty vital to them. They'd lost the League Cup final in 68 to Leeds. Embarrassingly lost the third division Swindon Town in 69. You know, they come back from, 3-0 down at one point in the first leg over in Brussels against Anderlecht. Ray Kennedy gets the late consolation, which eventually proves so pivotal. You know, and a very atmospheric night at Highbury sees it all turn around. They win the first cup and then suddenly it's the double the following year. You know, again, another one of those, you know, ways that football can twist very, very quickly, and a team that seems to be part of the middle pack suddenly comes through and takes, you know, huge glories.
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. As you say, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there are many who would believe that if Arsenal hadn't won the first cup that season, that team doesn't go on to win the double the next season, because sometimes it's that perfect combination. You've got a cohort of young players coming through who haven't quite got the big match experience, who suddenly come through, you know, what was a real maelstrom of a game. You know, at one moment they seemed the cup's going to be out to reach the 3-0 down to Anderlecht, and it doesn't seem to be way back. Because the away goals, they get one goal back. So suddenly that means, you know, they're only going to get win by two goals if you don't concede at Highbury. Then you see that, you know, the clips that game, the atmosphere as Highbury, and you can just see the belief growing with the crowd. A bit like what it is now for Arteta, the way you can see the crowd, you know, really believing the team's going to do something this season. You can sense it for that game there, the first cup game. Yeah, Ray Kennedy, who obviously went on to have a, you know, huge impact on his career, both at Arsenal and at Liverpool. But there's young players coming through there as well. You've got the experience there as well, like, so John Samuels, people like that, Frank Lintoff. So there's a real good combination of players there. And I always find this one of the strangest managerial stories. Now, you can't imagine a situation these days, can you, where a club physio suddenly ends up taking over from Pep Guardiola or from Jurgen Klopp or somebody and has just given the job because he knows the club inside out and he just trusts her to get on with it. And when you think, what a huge gamble that must have been. So I think he took over from Billy. Did he take over from Billy Rice or was somebody
Billy
in between?
Rice, I think it was Billy Rice.
So they've gone from the star-studded kind of, him and Joey Beverly were like the Posh and Becks of the era, weren't they? So, they'd gone from the glamour football manager to basically an office boy who kind of was in the background, but somehow managed to get the team together, put his faith in youth, combined it with experience. And, when you look at turnarounds in clubs' fortune, you know, we talked about Derby County before, the turnaround of Arsenal's fortunes under Bertie May, it just defies belief because there were a nondescript middling first division team who weren't particularly going anywhere. Okay, a couple of League Cup runs, but one of those was kind of scarred by the humiliation against Swindon Town. So the transformation was incredible. I mean, I think it's best to say the start of football would not have pleased everybody, but if you're an Arsenal fan, all you want to see is your team winning. And I think that sliding doors moments against Steve, it's like the phrase of our series, isn't it? If Arsenal don't win that first cup tie final in second leg, then do they go on next season to win the double? I think it's a really fascinating concept to consider.
Oh, completely. I mean, David, that first cup success for Arsenal shouldn't be undersold. I mean, they overcome Ajax in the semi-final. A team that had reached the European Cup final the year before would go on, the following three seasons to win a hat-trick of European Cups. Arsenal, the only team in that five-year span to beat Ajax in European competition away from a final. In the opposite semi-final, it's Anderlecht and Internazionale. I mean, it takes a lot to come through that quartet, to be on paper the weakest, element of that quartet in the semi-finals of the first cup and end up on top of the pile.
In a sense, the Bertie May Don Howe thing is not dissimilar to Joe Mercer, Malcolm Allison. Bertie May was a great manager. And Don Howe, I've spoken to many people who were with Don Howe at West Brom when he was the manager, was the worst man manager in history, some of them will tell you. nice fella, but a terrible man manager, but an absolute brilliant coach. I mean, one of the great English coaches of his era, all the work he did with England, with Wimbledon, with Arsenal, obviously, over various periods. And that was a formula that worked really well. But I spoke to Bob Wilson about the double team at one point. And he was saying that first cup win was the catalyst for everything. Because he said it wasn't just that the world saw Arsenal as losers because of those two League Cup defeats. He said within the squad, we felt like we were losers as well. And then that final, when they were, dead and buried in Belgium, the game was all over, and then all of a sudden they get that lifeline from the away goal, and then as you say that at Highbury that night, it was just those electrifying occasions, and you get that first trophy, and that makes the world a difference. Because now you're not losers anymore; you're winners. Not only are you winners, you're European winners. Which, at that stage was still a comparative rarity for an English club, Now you're suddenly a team to be reckoned with. And the belief that they got from that to then go from mid-table nobodies that season to the following year winning the double. I mean, that night was the one that did it.
Oh, totally. I mean, the springboard is incredible there because, even beyond the double, they reach another cup final in 72. They're in the shout of another double in 72, 73. They eventually kind of like fade out the title race and blow an FA Cup semi final to Sunderland. It's again in a way another team to add to Everton and Manchester City is that the moving through the early part of the 1970s to the middle of the 1970s, they probably should have done more than they actually did. Moving north of the border in true football-focused style, Celtic an incredible season, Paul. League champions, winners of the League Cup, they reach and lose both the Scottish Cup final and the European Cup final. Jock Steen, working his magic again. He kind of took Feyenoord for granted somewhat in the European Cup final. I've obviously written the book, and done more than my first year of research that will not be dislodged from my head. But he saw the semi final against Leeds as being the de facto final. He felt that if I can beat Leeds in the final, then Feyenoord should be an absolute doddle. And a lot of the you read the interviews and the build up to the 1970 European Cup final, and he did take Feyenoord lightly.
Yeah, I think you're right, Steve. Obviously, I'm going to defer to your knowledge on this. I'm not going to question any of your thorough research and insights into this. I'll just offer some random personal opinions here. The whole Leeds Celtic semi-final was just billed as the final, but basically from a British perspective. It was kind of labelled as the Battle of Britain. The second leg at Hampden Park, where I think the crowd was something ridiculous, about 135,000 or something like that. I still think it's the highest attendance for a non-European, a European Cup title was in the final. And what atmosphere, and Celtic, a one off in the first leg. I think they scored about the first 1 or 2 minutes to take a really early lead out of those. Second leg, it's 0-0, and then Billy Bremner hits an absolute corker of a shot to put Leeds ahead. And at that moment, you think, Leeds might just be doing this here. Now, Leeds wasn't helped by, I think Gary Sprake got injured. He has to be replaced by David Harvey halfway through the second half as well. And then, but once Celtic got the game back to one each, the roar, the noise, the intensity, and you could just, it wasn't often that Leeds United wilted, but you could just see that they just couldn't cope with the occasion, the atmosphere, and the way that Celtic just went at them nonstop to get the victory. Fabulous game of football. It's always one worth checking out on YouTube as well. And I just think you can understand why Celtic. I see. You can always understand the mentality of that. That was our hardest game here, right? We've just got to turn off the European Cup final because we're far better than this team of Hollers. What are they called again? What's their pedigree? What's their history? And also, I think as well, given the fact that they all came internationally when nobody fans them to do so in 1967, they must have gone out there with such a huge sort of vat of confidence inside them, think that there's no way we can lose it. And whether you've done more research than me, Stephen, whether it's the case that you didn't prepare tactically enough, whether they hadn't quite done the research on the opposition, whether they just kind of assumed that after having beaten Leeds, we're just going to steamroll the team to win the European Cup, whether they felt, sometimes teams have this mentality that they did to win a competition. Maybe they thought that as well. I'm not quite sure. But you look once again at pivotal moments here. If Celtic win the European Cup that season, where does that then take them? Where does that take Jock Steen, in terms of his standing as a manager? Because it's one of these strange things, isn't it? Matt Busby got knighted for Man United to win the European Cup. Jock Steen had done the year before, didn't get knighted. Part of the reason apparently was because of the fracas of the Intercontinental Cup final that they had with Racing Club, meant that the establishment weren't very positive about the view of this sort of team of brawling Scotsmen having their manager being nice. And so instead, Matt Busby could get to it instead. And to me, that's still a massive injustice. Why the hell was Jock Steen not nice? It's absolutely terrible. It's probably the best argument the Scottish independents never said to come up with. But it could have been huge for Celtic to win that European Cup. And then not winning it kind of then starts a slight decline of Celtic over the next few years as well. So, it's one we should have won, and they didn't.
They were immortal already, and they've come very, very close to, an extra dose of immortality there. To lose out to Aberdeen in the Scottish Cup final and Feyenoord in the European Cup final, who've proper sucker punched them. It's been a sharp surprise for Celtic in that European Cup final. slight gust of wind in the opposite direction. It's still a magnificent season for Celtic. I mean, they win the title by 12 points. You know, they take the Scottish League Cup. You know, there is a six-month span in the league where they drop just 3 points. They only lose one game and draw a further one, I think, against Rangers. Defeat against Hearts, you know, after a little bit of a disjointed start to the season. You know, they are on a phenomenal run, as Paul said. They do blow Leeds away in that semi-final.
It was a magnificent team, obviously, and it was a magnificent team over quite a spell. I mean, just looking at that run, the one thing that always amuses me is against Benfica. 3-0 winner down, 3-0 defeat away. Nobody had thought of penalties. So they tossed a coin and Celtic won. Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose it's gust of wind in that direction. Celtic won't get the European Cup final. I mean, I think it was the following year, and Aberdeen were the first team to go out on penalty. It was the following year that they brought a penalty shootout in, and they were the first one to, I think they lost to Honved in the Cup Winners' Cup. You'll know more about that than me. but how did nobody think of that before then? You know, who thought that tossing a coin or drawing lots or whatever was a good way of deciding the game? It's bizarre. Anyway, more important. I mean, in a sense, you can understand them taking Feyenoord, like, because Dutch football at that point really had achieved, well, precious little had it really. You know, it wasn't as, you know, if they'd been up against Inter again in the final, then I'm sure they would have, you know, there would have been a much more polished preparation. They would have been absolutely ready for the game. And maybe they would have gone on and won it again. But as you say, it's amazing that somebody as professional and as polished and as thorough as Jock Steen would get to a European Cup final and think, OK, lads, now all we've got to do is turn up and win. And yet that's what all the stories say. It's a bizarre state of affairs. And to let a second European Cup, I mean, that really is the stuff of legend. You know, they win it in 67, then win it again in 1970. I mean, that's putting you really right up there with the great elite of Europe, isn't it? And to let that slip through your fingers so lightly, then in Glasgow they must be still cursing that afternoon, that evening rather, to this day. You know, it's an extraordinary failure. Really, absolutely extraordinary.
I mean, it's not a particularly poor Feyenoord side. I mean, it's terrible, but I mean, I think the only thing that should have set an alarm bell is the fact that Ajax had been there a year earlier. Would have been the wake up call to say, hang on, you know, something must be stirred in the lowlands. You know, because he is a second successive year where Dutch teams reached the final. But beyond that as well, there's still, you know, hard luck stories in the European Cup for them in 72 against Inter. They lose a semi-final and in such rancorous terms against Atletico Madrid in 74 as well. You know, it could have really been, you know, 2, 3 or 4 European Cups that Jock Steen won over what would have been a 7-year span between 67 and 74. You know, truly, truly remarkable. Moving back south, you know, other points of call, Malcolm McDonald, free scoring striker in the third division with Luton Town, attracting the interest of Newcastle United with his exploits there. Don Masson is free scoring for Notts County in the fourth division. Before the decade's over, he's scoring in the World Cup for Scotland against Peru from the penalty spot in Argentina. And Bradford Park Avenue bid a sad farewell to the Football League and go out of business just 4 years later to eventually rise again in 1989. Paul, Bradford Park Avenue.
What a tragic story this is, Stephen. Absolutely. I mean, but it's just something about Bradford Park Avenue. It's the name. The name is fantastic, Bradford Park Avenue. I love the name. It's the ground. I love the fact the ground was shared as a cricket ground. I love the fact the stadium had part of the main stand called the Doll's House. You see pictures of it. It's just, I know, it really is such a picturesque football stadium. And the kits the club wore, you know, they had this white kit with a green V in the 50s that was so futuristic, it was untrue for a lower league team. And then they had the other hoop design with things white, amber, and black hoops, or white, amber, and red hoops. It's just a really, really colourful kiss, a colourful name. a very picturesque stadium. Everything about the club, it just conjures up. It brings out the tears to the eyes of any football romantic. And then it just makes it even more sad that, you know, this team ends up in such a catastrophic state. You mentioned Kevin Hector there. Now, Kevin Hector arguably single-handedly kept Bradford Park Avenue as a mid-table Division 4 team whilst he was there. He was their top scorer for four seasons on the run. In his final season, 65-66, I think he scored 44 goals in a team that finishes 11th. You think, well, if he's not scoring those goals, where's that team going to finish? And as ever, finances indicate that, you know, these players have to leave Division 4. So Kevin Hector goes on, signed by Brian Clough's Derby County, as mentioned before. And then Bradford then have to pick up the pieces of losing their star player. And then the fourth season after he leaves, well, it really can't get any worse. So in successive seasons, they finished 23rd, 24th, 24th, 24th. That is just, you can't survive with a record like that. The points for those four totals for those four seasons were 35, 23, 20, 23. So this is a club in a serious, serious state of decline. Despite that, the attendance hold up quite well. They're still averaging 4,000 for home games in 69-70, which is a lot better than other kind of teams in that division at the time. And strangely enough, their last away win as a league club was away at Bradford City in the Bradford Derby. And, you know, I always get really upset when City derbies are no more because one of the teams, you know, has dropped out of the league. Because I think if Bradford Park had remained in the league, then it would have given Yorkshire two City derbies. I think that would have made Yorkshire the only county that would have two league derbies within the county boundaries. Maybe wrong now. I'm sure somebody will correct me on that. It's just a really historic feel about the club. And it's just such a shame the way it was last declined like that. So I've got this great book here about the history of re-election, rejected FC. It's fascinating stuff. When Bradford Park Avenue, the previous season, 68-69, and bear in mind, this is the third season they've applied for, you know, to stay in the Football League. They score 38 votes, and the nearest non-league rivals, Wigan Athletic, get 11. So by a comfortable margin of 27 votes, the league place is safe. Cambridge United that same season get two votes. There's a 35-vote gap between the two teams. When it comes to re-election for Bradford's final season in the league, suddenly, you know, the balance has swung considerably. Now, I know Cambridge United won the Southern League that season. They won the Southern League twice in the previous three seasons. They were definitely on a bandwagon, and there was definitely that they'd done the marketing well. They'd really pushed their case. And when I went to the voting, Donaldson Hartlepool were re-elected with 47-42 votes. Cambridge come in third with 31 votes. Newport County had 31 votes. Bradford don't even make the top six. Wigan Athletic also finished higher than Bradford in the voting, so they come fifth. And Bradford Park Avenue get 17 votes, and they're out of the league. The reapplies the next two seasons got one vote on each of those two occasions, and then by 73-74, the financial mismanagement, and the team was gone. Played their last ever game in the Northern Premier League against Grays Harwood Town in front of 687 spectators. What an awful feeling that must have been. Yeah, it's just really sad. It's just incredibly sad what happened to Bradford Park Avenue. It's brilliant that they've reformed, although they've kind of operated National League North level now. I think they're near the bottom three, so a bit of a struggle where things are going up this season. But it was just part of a general trend then. You know, we talked about the re-election process, but there was definitely a feeling of, into the 50s and 60s, this idea of a northern cult of northern teams being leaving the league to be replaced by the more prosperous southern counterparts with larger populations. So you had, you know, New Brighton, who were voted out in 51, Gateshead, who were voted out in 60, to be replaced by Peterborough. Atkinson were effectively, you know, weren't supported by the league to stay in the league, so they're replaced taken by Oxford United. Bradford Park Avenue were replaced by Cambridge United. Barrow were replaced by Hereford United. Worcester replaced by Wimbledon, and then Southport replaced by Wigan. So that's like seven members of the old Third Division North all lost their places. And five out of those seven were replaced by the new conurbations, you know, the new prosperous non-league clubs from down south as well. But it's kind of reflects, I guess, shifting trends of population and things like that as well. I can't even begin to imagine what it's like And I'm sure Benny supporters who were going through this 2 seasons ago, what it's like to support a team and just see them fold in front of your very eyes, and see them, you know, drop out the league, and 3 seasons later, the team's gone, the history's gone. And it's just fantastic that the way a group of supporters have managed to revive the club, get them back to semi-professional status. And who knows, one day, I would absolutely love for Grafenbrock Avenue to come back to the Football League. If you're a football romantic, read about Grafenbrock Avenue. It's just a fantastic club with a fantastic history. It's just been a sad watch of the game, the fact they're not in the Football League anymore.
I mean, Dave, Bradford Park Avenue, I mean, this is a team that spent, I think it was about 3 seasons in the First Division, straddling either side of the First World War. You know, a lot of character to them. You know, the great Vic Buckingham managed them. It was the first league club that Vic Buckingham managed. You know, even as late as, I think it's 67 or 68, Buckingham goes back to Bradford Park Avenue with Fulham in the FA Cup. You know, so they are having these travails, but still having a decent cup run to the third round to face First Division opposition. The goals of Kevin Hector in the middle of the decade, as Paul said, 44, 45 goals, 65, 66. You know, as recently as 62, 63, just, what, 7 years before the kick down to the Football League, they're still playing third division football at that point in time. I mean, these are stark. It's a stark drop, but this, like Paul said, this propensity to try, you know, to move a northern club out of the Football League to replace it by a prosperous area of the south is very much a thing. I don't think that can be denied. But yeah, Bradford Park Avenue, an ailing club, clearly 3 successive seasons finishing bottom of the Football League, something that can't be sustained. But at the same time, a huge amount of history there to be brushed out of the Football League.
Yeah, Paul's right. I mean, it is a sad thing that they disappeared and then literally disappeared 3 or 4 years later. I mean, it was a completely different landscape than to now, isn't it? When you dropped out of the league then, there was no mechanism for getting back into it, particularly other than this arcane re-election concept, which must have been open to all kinds of skullduggery from club and other brown envelopes passing from one chair.
I'll just throw in there as well, what always used to kind of like really kind of like fry my mind on this is that every year this vote took place at the Café Royal in London. And it was kind of like this palatial kind of environment for such dirty work to take place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, that sort of sums up the shift from the north to the south, doesn't it? But I mean, as well, it doesn't make a great deal of sense. Why are the bottom four all applying for re-election? Because if you finish bottom, you're the worst team, aren't you? You know, just natural sporting law suggests that, okay, you stay in the league, but you're the one that's threatened, and the three above you should be okay. I suppose it is a much healthier situation for a Bradford Park Avenue type club nowadays, with the conference or the National League sitting there below it. It's a kind of a safety net of sorts. I mean, you know, we've talked in many podcasts of late how difficult it is to get out of that league and how many former league clubs are still languishing in there. But at least there's a route back. You know, we've seen plenty of clubs. I mean, Luton now are on the brink of the Premier League, having dropped into the National League, what, 10 years ago or something. Had they been up for re-election and been kicked out and just disappeared into the, you know, the Southern League or whatever it was at that point, maybe they would never have come back, you know. So I think in that sense, for lower division teams, that has proved a real boost. Although obviously they don't want to go out the league, it does give them some sort of breathing space to try and come back again. But I mean, in a sporting context, it's very difficult if you finish bottom of the 92, 3 years in a row. It's very difficult to justify how you then carry on and finish bottom again the following year in all likelihood. So, I mean, you know, you can understand the fact that patience finally ran out. But maybe it was just the brown envelopes ran out. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure that voting process was almost like a precursor for what went on in FIFA with the World Cup, you know, a few decades later, wasn't it? Because I'm sure the Café Royale, there were all sorts of shenanigans going on behind the scenes there. We actually played Dave Brown almost being passed around, you know, female entertainers visiting hotel rooms at night time and things like this to try and show but to go a certain way. I'm sure, you know, the
family show, Paul, be careful.
I know, but it's just after the watershed, so you know, but of course, in those days, you know, the press weren't quite as keen on digging deep for these sort of stories, were they? You just get a taste of a headline. I think there was one year when Wigan Athletic thought they were going to be voted in. And because they were so obviously gloating about the fact we were going to go in, I think they presented a set of pens to all the delegates to say, welcome to the Football League, Wigan Athletic, something like that. And they ended up losing the vote because of that. And that was just kind of at the surface of what was going on the voting processes there. So yeah, that's a really good point you made there, Dave. But why were 14 advisors for re-election? It should only be one, shouldn't it? You know, and also why did so many different non-league teams apply to be electors? Because it would have made more sense if there came some sort of consensus that just one team each year is going to apply to be re-elected to get that place. I think there came to that agreement towards the start of the 80s as the best way forward, because you had these perennial teams like South Liverpool applying to get a league place, Nelson applying to get back into the league, even New Brighton applied a few times to get back into the league. When there was really no chance of that happening whatsoever.
Total lack of coordination in that respect. It is a better scenario now. I mean, we do have a system where, you know, you can start at the lowest point and climb as far as, you know, all the way up to the Premier League if you so have the, you know, if you have the wind to do so. Moving towards the tail end of the season, the finish of the season, you know, that bizarrety of early FA Cup finals and the season being over by mid to late April is to make way for the World Cup. We've done so much World Cup content over the years, but this is just a very quick one on England. You know, the only British nation at the 1970 World Cup. Peculiarity, Dave, that, you know, four games that they play in Mexico, yet it's the two that they lose that has gained iconic status in the World Cup. No one really considers the 1-0 victories against Romania and Czechoslovakia, yet it's all about the 1-0 defeat to Brazil and the 3-2 capitulation to West Germany.
I think that says something about the national character, really, somehow, more than the... they were spectacular games, weren't they? You know, I mean, the Brazilian game was... It got all the ingredients of a top world-class, absolute world-class football from both sides. So, I mean, I think you can understand why that one's there. And then, it was the end of the world when they lost to West Germany. 50-odd years on, it's all turned into caricatures, isn't it? You know, it's all Gordon Banks drinking the wrong orange juice and Peter Benetti, you know, the poor devil, his entire, you know, marvellous career at Chelsea, and his entire career is boiled down to 120 minutes for England. That's a personal tragedy, I would think. But no, you're right. I think they went there with such optimism. You know, I think it was kind of widely agreed that they were a better squad than it had been the case in England in 1966. I think there were real expectations that they would at least get to the final. The nature of the defeat against West Germany, having been 2-0 up, was the thing that everybody had found so difficult to cope with. But I think that said a lot about Alf Ramsey. I think just how big the substitutions were, I mean, you know, that's always for conjecture, but I think it summed up that he was a man that was coming to the end of his useful period as a manager. I think the game was changing. Substitutions were a new thing. And as we were saying, you know, in connection with other stuff earlier, he was a man of his time, and his time was beginning to depart. And, you know, we talked about Feyenoord there in the European Cup, and obviously Dutch football was coming, total football was coming, the West German team that, you know, absolutely took England apart a couple of years later at Wembley was coming, and England were, they had some great players, better players perhaps than 4 years, but they were playing an older version of the game that was just beginning to overtake them. I think perhaps they deserved to be in the semi-finals, perhaps they even deserved to be in the final, but the game was moving and we weren't, I think was the story of that World Cup in the end. If you take away the caricatures of having to lose to West Germany and that sort of stuff away from it, I think it was indicative of, just as our teams, our club teams were getting stronger and stronger in European competition, the national team was losing its way.
Oh, completely. Paul, I mean, I've often said before that England tend to go out of major international competitions where they deserve to, given that it was Brazil, Uruguay, Italy and West Germany who made the semi-finals in 1970. Can we really argue that England didn't go out where they deserved to in 1970? And as well, would, especially as Gary's not here to add his conjecture, would Gordon West have made a difference against West Germany?
Yes, one of those things we'll never know is just being, yeah, I mean, I do agree with David. I think, you know, Paul Opie's message being so unfairly maligned for, you know, for the one slight edit of judgment that I know. Okay, put West Germany back in the game, but it didn't actually win West Germany the game. They still scored another two goals to make it a 3-2 victory. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, 1970 was the first World Cup with subs but allowed, you know, whereas the 66 subs haven't been allowed. So you wonder how would that game have developed if subs hadn't been allowed and Ramsey, you know, Ramsey didn't have to make those changes, which were catastrophic in the end, weren't they? I mean, what always found me surprised was the fact that in the World Cup final 66, Charlton had nullified the threat of Beckenbauer, and he was doing it again in the quarter final. But then, for some reason, he decides to take Charlton off, and suddenly Beckenbauer finds himself with the freedom the party takes full advantage of. And I think England's defending generally in that last 20 minutes or so of normal time and extra time really lacked something. You know, they weren't picking people up. People were allowed to come in on goal unchallenged. I know that he's Seth played a huge factor there as well. So going back to your original point there, Steve, you know, was that the right stage for us to go out at? Well, I suppose if you win 2-0 in a quarter final of a cup contest with 20 minutes to go, you've every right to expect that you're going to go on to the semi-final. And equally, if you then blow a 2-0 lead in a quarter final, then what were you expecting? It's kind of quite viewed from, you mentioned the start of this team, but it's like kind of gold tinted lenses that the 70 World Cup, because there were a lot better teams in England than World Cup to in my mind as well. And I mean, the group stages, I think we scored, was it one goal more from play for the two goals that we scored? So we haven't exactly gone into it in a prolific run of form. The football, I have to say, in the group stage was pretty dire apart from the Brazil game. There was nothing really scary. I haven't received the excitement. The best game we played was in the quarter final for the first 70 minutes. So we absolutely played a style of football that, you know, we haven't really seen from Ramsey's teams before. They're quite open, they're quite innovative, they're quite adventurous. But I think once it got back to 2 weeks, I remember watching the game as a young teenager thinking, we're going to lose this. You get the sense that the momentum's gone the other way. You just can't see any way we can get ourselves back into this game. And so the eventual outcome of those catastrophic really was quite, you know, was predictable. All I want to say was that the one advantage of West Germany going through was it then enabled me to watch one of the classic World Cup semi-finals when Italy beat West Germany 4-3. I remember still about 1:30, 2 in the morning watching that before going to school the next day, absolutely shattered, because that really is one of the best World Cup semi-finals or World Cup games that I've ever had the pleasure to watch. And these days, the idea of a Cost Legendre came on with his ominous link.
Beckenbauer went off and got in, strapped up and then thrown back
on. Yeah. Back on. Absolutely brilliant, isn't it? The idea of this player come back on with his arm in a sling. You know, in a game of that importance, you know, it's just absolutely brilliant. So, If I'm not looking from a biasing perspective, quarterfinals might have been our level.
I think so, but yeah, like you say, double-sided coin of a game. But brilliant, a brilliant start to the series, Paul and Dave. Biggest takeaway from 1969-70, Paul, is surely obviously Everton's title win.
I'm not going to argue with that, am I, Stephen? Come on. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a moment that kind of indicated a brighter decade on the horizon, but as we discussed in subsequent episodes of this series, it didn't happen.
And Dave, what's your predominant take from 69-70? What's your reset image, your reset event?
There's never been a greater FA Cup final than the 1970 FA Cup final.
We're totally with you on that, Dave. Totally with you.
Oh, fantastic.
You can take Stanley Matthews. You can take Steven Gerrard. I'm sorry.
Oh, brilliant stuff. And a great way to wind it up tonight. Paul, thanks so much for your contributions. Wonderful as always.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having us on the pod, and thanks for giving us all a chance to speak and keeping the conversation flowing. And thanks for all your insights to add depth and quality to our discussion as well.
Oh, thank you, Paul. You are a gentleman. And thanks, Dave, as well. And a wonderful way to start the series.
Yep, thanks for hosting, Stephen. I think it's a good start to a glorious decade. I think a lot of it actually does get better even than 1970.
Magnificent. One down, nine to go. Thank you so much for listening. This has been another podcast from These Football Times. And please tune in for the next episode, which will quite obviously be 1970-71. And a team in red and white towards Islington do quite well. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.